My ideas come from everywhere. They come from people, like just walking on the street, interactions. I'm inspired by everything. Like, it doesn't take much.
Welcome to the Idea Generation Podcast, a show about creative entrepreneurship. My name is Noah Callahan Bever, and each week I'll be speaking with some of the most innovative ideators in culture and trying to figure out how they make their creative decisions. This week, I'm talking to Beth Burkett, founder of Beffy's Beauty Supply. This podcast is brought to you by the good people at Shopify. Feeling that entrepreneurial itch? Turn your passion into a business with Shopify. They've got everything you need to start, run, or grow your business. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. Beth Burkett knows a thing or two about culture and influence. A player in the emergent Soho streetwear scene of the 90s, she worked at brands like Stussy and Fat Farm, which created opportunities for her at larger, adjacent companies like MTV and Arista Records. Yet, no matter how high she rose, she faced familiar, gendered roadblocks. However, despite her crash course in corporate politics, she learned plenty of lessons about entrepreneurship at home.
My dad, even though he was in the military and he was in school for a lot of my life, he was also, he had a lot of businesses. He was like an entrepreneur and an inventor. And, you know, he just kind of hustled. And I definitely learned a lot from watching my dad's mistakes. And also watching his successes. So it definitely informed just like even like the value of money, you know, valuing it not so much where you're like obsessed with it, but, you know, but you definitely need it and knowing the importance of like getting the right people that know if you don't know how to handle money, how to handle money. So yeah, my parents definitely, like my mom was always really good with money and I don't think he valued that in my mom. And so, yeah, I think that, that informed me too of just how women we're not really valued for, you know, for these things because we're not seen to be really good at math or good at accounting. I just learned a lot from that, for sure.
What do you think was motivating his sort of drive towards entrepreneurship?
I think my dad was really creative, but because, you know, my parents are from the Caribbean, even though my dad is from Harlem, he's from Barbados. His great-grandparents actually came from Ellis Island to New York, which is rare for a lot of African Americans. On my dad's side. And my mom is also, she's from Jamaica. And so, you know, in a small island like the Caribbean, they don't really, you know, they don't value creativity. They value education. They value education over anything. So my parents were very educated. They didn't know that you could be both creative and business savvy. So I guess that's what I've learned. I feel like creativity and not necessarily like, you know, the financial part of business, but just like how to navigate a business. I think there is a lot of creativity that goes into like what product that you're making. We like to think that like as designers that we're just, you know, making something because it's beautiful or it's cool. But there's a lot of like thought that goes into that outside of, you know, outside of the visual part that we don't think about. And I think tapping into that part of your creativity, I don't think people really value that, you know, doing both.
So where did that sort of passion come from in your life?
The passion of being able to do what you love, I guess, seeing that it didn't come so easy for my parents because I think they weren't really being true to who they were. I tapped into, you know, what my creativity was. And I don't know, it just taught me that. And I also learned a lot, like, just business-wise from their failures. I learned that, like, it's okay to fail, that failing is a huge part of being a success.
Absolutely. Growing up, you moved around quite a bit. How did that experience sort of shape your worldview?
Oh, it was everything. I think, you know, I'm really all about being multicultural. I think that's why, you know, I've been able to be in a lot of spaces, is because I, you know, because of the people I've been exposed to, you know, spending summers in Jamaica, but also, you know, being a Black kid that was being the only Black kid in a lot of my classes and a lot of my living situation, like growing up, and always kind of being an outsider, definitely made me appreciate that. And it opened a ton of doors for me, because people looked at me one way and they were like, oh, I didn't know you knew that kind of music, or you knew that information on other cultures. And I think a lot of people at that time, people didn't move around as much. So I was a rare kind of person.
what were you like at 16?
I was always very independent. Like, I was definitely had a job at 16. I worked in retail. I worked at a mall. I was into fashion, or I thought I was. I really wasn't into school, because I don't think my school, you know, I always wanted to go to performing arts high school.
Yeah, where did you go to school?
I went to school in California. School was called Highland High School, and it's just north of LA.
Okay.
And yeah, it was just very, it was not inspiring. And so I wasn't really into school. I always thought I was, like, better than that. I always liked working. So by the time I was a junior in high school, I had a part-time job, and I would leave early to, like, go to work.
Cause what were you doing? You know,
working at a retail store, working at DJ's. yeah. So, I was always, I don't know, just very independent, just wanting to figure things out on my own. And then I moved when I was 17, like, literally, like, right after graduation, moved to New York. And I didn't move to New York, like, knowing what college I was going to go to. I kind of, like, lived in New York and then applied. Yeah. And then later, like, got accepted. I ended up going to the new school, Parsons. And, but I was in New York. I did the whole community college thing, like, really just lived life, which I think made me appreciate school when I was actually in it. You know, because once you work and you realize how hard it is, it gives you more of a focus or a purpose.
How did, take me through this conversation with your parents. I'm going to move to New York. I'm 17. How were they comfortable with this?
Well, I mean, I'm originally from New York, so I have a lot of family there. So they were fine with it.
Okay.
When I first moved there, I lived with family.
Okay.
So yeah, they were totally. And I was always very independent, so it wasn't shocking. It wasn't shocking for them. And yeah, I had, like, a bunch of different jobs in New York. I had a lot of internships. And actually, the internships kind of made me, yeah, want to go back to school. And so it
really
gave me a focus, yeah.
Where were you interning?
I actually, one of my first internships was for Kiss FM.
Oh.
Before it turned to Hot 97. It was Kiss FM. DJ Red Alert was the DJ, the resident DJ there. And I worked for, like, a couple of the disc jockeys. And I would go when it was, like, all tapes and cartridges. And that was my job. I would, like, switch out the tapes and help them when they were, like, splicing the the audio together. So, yeah, that was my first internship.
Did you have much of a sense of like what you wanted to do?
I actually wanted to, I thought I wanted to do broadcasting.
Okay.
And my aunt at the time, she worked in broadcast journalism. And so, yeah, I wanted to work with her, but I couldn't. So, so I looked into internships and I lucked into Kiss FM.
After moving to New York, Beth's interest in fashion would lead her to a series of retail jobs on New York's Prince Street, just as the roots of its iconic streetwear scene were being planted. Soon she would start connecting with the likes of James Jebbia, founder of Supreme, as well as Def Jam's Russell Simmons.
So I did some fashion marketing at Parsons, and then I did literature at art at New School and Eugene Lang. And so, so yeah. And then while I was there, I did a bunch of internships. I interned at Elle Magazine. I first worked at a place called Jerry's, which was across the street from the old Stussy on Prince Street. Mm-hmm. I think there's an Apple store there now. And then I worked at Fat Farm, and that's how I started. I was working there for, I don't know, maybe like a year or so. So Russell had, you know, his nephew was kind of like his intern, but he would get into trouble a lot. Like, you know, they'd send him on errands and just like there was always drama. And so they needed someone to take his place, and they asked me to just move up and work in the office with Russell and Simone Reyes. So
that was your first entree into like streetwear and...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at the time, I would say that's when Ali Asha, who is now, he's like a staple in just more the skate community. He has a brand. He was designing for Fat Farm, and at the time it was like, it was really dope. Like he was doing the fireman jackets that were a big hit. They were in every music video, all of Wu-Tang. Every artist you could imagine would come through the store and you know, wear the clothes, buy the clothes. Like it was really like that was, I feel like it was a really... It was the beginning of streetwear.
What would you say if you were trying to describe to a kid today? What's the energy?
Well, it was still very music, right? So it was like, you know, so it was Russell Simmons had Fat Farm. And then I think shortly after Jay-Z had Rockaware. But before that, you also had, you know, Cross Colors was a thing when I was in high school. I remember getting in a fight with a girl who like stole my Cross Colors, like... It was like drama. Carl Kanai, FUBU. So it was kind of segueing into this, like, you know, this, it always was a music thing, right? Like artists were always wearing it because it was the only clothes they had access to. You know, high fashion wasn't giving clothes to rappers. Certainly. At the time, you know? And so there was that part. And then there were also stores like Union, which was like one of the first stores on Spring Street. And that was one of James Jebbia's first stores that eventually Marianne Fusco would end up running, and it became her store. So it was that first. And then he had a thing with Stussy, and then he was opening up Supreme. And then I started working for him. And this is where it gets confusing. I'm like, I think I worked for him either before or after or both, because I met Bianca. We became really good friends. And
So you're working at Fat Farm. And then from there, you meet James, who's sort of taking over the Soho streetwear world one store at a time. And then you end up working for him.
Yeah, well, at the time we were friends, right? It was like James was just like, yeah, he was just a friend, and he happened to, you know, have Union, have Stussy, and Prince Street. So Prince Street, this is where I first started working at Jerry's. That's when I met Bianca. So you kind of knew everyone on the block.
Okay.
And so Stussy was across the street, and Fat Farm was down the street, still on Prince Street. So it was like, it was, you know, that was like the block. And I pretty much worked at every store on that block. And I became, you know, friends with James and Bianca and Marianne. And it was
And who was?
She worked there with us. At Stussy at the time.
Okay.
And so we met and we became really good friends. So, and just always kind of like helped each other out, you know? And so it was cool because at the time James was like a peer, mm-hmm. you know? So it was like, yeah, whatever. Like, hey, I have this store. It's really cool. You want to work here? Sure. Yeah. Okay, cool. You know, it was like my really bad English accent, but, but that's how it was. And it was just like, everybody was just kind of hustling and doing their thing. And it wasn't people, I don't know if everybody had these grand dreams of like having a streetwear brand or business or any of that. It was just like, we were
being
all
a billionaire.
Super young. Being a billionaire. Like no one was thinking like that. It was just like, oh, we're really cool. And we all like each other and get along. And it kind of became a little community.
And where is your head as you're sort of like getting more exposed, seeing this world and still very young and trying to figure out, you know, what your career path is going to be?
Well, working with Russell Simmons, working in the music industry, I think, period, you know, it definitely got me, it got me excited about like business. And it didn't feel like business, but it was the music industry. And it was like, we were all young and we had like such high positions. Right. And it definitely was harder being a woman in that arena because people didn't really take me seriously. And it wasn't that I didn't work hard because I was there, you know, everybody, like you went to the parties, you were there at the parties and the clubs because you were also working, you were having fun. It was very genuine, like listening to the music, but a lot of A&Rs would go to clubs to hear what music is hot or DJs or radio people, you know, like it was kind of like your job. And I worked in all those areas and I cared about the culture too. But it was like when people saw me there, it was like, oh, she just likes to go out all the time and she just likes to party. And it's just like, yeah, so do you. Like, you're partying and having fun too. But that was definitely harder to navigate because unless you were, you know, someone's girlfriend or an assistant, it was really hard to move up as a woman. You know, and to even be taken seriously. And then I noticed all the assistants, like Simone was Russell's assistant for like 30 years, you know, like years. And so that would be the peak as you become an executive assistant. And so I never wanted to do that. So I just tried a bunch of different things and, I don't know. I mean, yeah, a lot of it was just like luck, like opportunities would arise. And so after working with Russell for a couple of years, being like a second assistant, and Def Jam, which I feel like that's where I got most of my growth. I got offered a job working at MTV, being like a music programmer. And I was really young. I was like, I don't know, probably like 22, 23. And it was literally, it was like an influencer job. It was like, oh, you know, all these people, you know, music. And really it wasn't just like, I knew hip hop. It's like, I knew hip hop. I knew alternative rock. I knew all the different genres because, you know, I grew up in the suburbs too. I grew up with a bunch of white kids. So I was always open to other music. I didn't just grew up with like hip hop and R&B, you know, and my parents weren't, you know, they weren't really into music and the arts. So I really just discovered it all on my own. And there was value to that. And so I, you know, became an executive at MTV really when I was really young. But that, you know, that had challenges because I was so young. Again, no one took me seriously. Like they didn't know that I could actually help them get music played. But I met like a lot of really cool artists. Like I became really good friends with like Pharrell and the Neptunes and Rob and Chad and, you know, just started creating our little crews. And then, you know, eventually Pharrell segued into his own kind of streetwear brand, which I would say I put him on to.
Her experience at Fat Farm put her on the radar of owner Russell Simmons, who quickly elevated her to his flagship company, Def Jam Recordings. Her next two jobs were also in music, but she quickly found out how her race and gender would gate her success.
What was that environment of Def Jam in the mid-90s like?
It was amazing, actually. I mean, I was always seen as the weirdo. Like, they were like, oh, Beth from Cali, why are you always smiling all the time? Like, no one really got me, but it didn't matter. It was just, it felt like a really kind of free time, you know, because hip-hop was still in this, like, it was in this stage where it was like growing, and then being at Def Jam where you had like, you know, Run DMC, but then you also had the Beastie Boys and, you know, and then you had Russell and then you had Lior. And yeah, it was a very like multicultural environment, even though it wasn't really. It was Black culture, but everyone was accepted, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, it was fun because a lot of people got jobs and positions based on their style, based on, you know, things that you wouldn't even think of as qualifications to be running or having a job. But, even a lot of my guy friends would be like, yeah, I was wearing like, you know, Lior was like, oh, that's a dope kufi you're wearing. You should come work at Def Jam kind of thing. So, and then obviously you had all the artists and then the people that came up with them, they were normally their friends. So it was just like a really young, thriving environment. And everybody, you know, was hustling, whether it was like, you know, trying to get their music off the ground. But then you also had like the business of the music industry, which was like, you know, they had the street team, who went to all the radio stations at the time and like, you know, and they were in different, you know, regions of the US. Like they were in the South, they were, you know, in the Bronx, they were in LA, and they would be, you know, there was the little street team. And it really was like about community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I learned about Def Jam, like how connected everybody was, even though it was from this little place in New York. It was like people had connections to the South. They had connections up, you know, in the West, and how radio played a big part and now it doesn't. But that's why it was like this community-based thing, because it was all based around radio stations.
What was that adjustment like to go from this very bootstrapped, entrepreneurial, crazy rap world to, you know, the most corporate part of Viacom, working at MTV?
It was hard. I mean, I think, and again, like it was hard for me because people that I looked up to, people that I worked with, like Russell wore whatever he wanted. He talked crazy. He would be in business meetings and he'd be like, yeah, like he would just talk crazy. He would be cursing. He would like completely inappropriate, but it was like he was Russell Simmons. And he would even bring me into meetings. Like it was like, yeah, come in and listen in on this meeting. And if I wanted to chime in, I could. And he'd be like, yeah, ask Beth. She's like, she's young. She's like younger and she has her ear to the streets and like, tell them Beth, like tell them what they want. And it was just like, it wasn't this like, and then when you go to MTV, it was like very like conservative and like, you know, people pretended like they wanted to hear your ideas, but they really didn't care. And so it just, it felt like, I actually really hated being at MTV. I didn't appreciate it because I was like, wow, I'm here because I'm like a token Black girl. Like I'm here because I'm like, I make them look diverse. And I'm like this young Black girl in this position, but it's not really a position. It's like made up. It's like I'm the model, you know? And I hated it. And people knew that, you know? And so, but I would speak up. I spoke up in meetings. But then coming from Def Jam, I also felt very comfortable talking to people at the time, like Judy McGrath or Van Toffler, who were the head of MTV at the time, who were like executives. But I, you know, my old boss was also an executive. So I didn't feel like intimidated. I wasn't like, I was just like, yeah. And, you know, I was very honest with them constantly. And they appreciated it. But it definitely felt like, oh, yeah, you're here because they had the people at MTV that had been working there pretty much since the beginning. So then there was that dynamic, like the old rock dudes that were like, we need more rock on the channel. Like, you know, and it was a lot of beef. And shout out to Fred Jordan. Like really, like I owe Fred Jordan so much. Rest in peace. He was the reason why I was there. And yeah. We were really close. So, yeah, he was a token for a long time. And he begged, he finally was like, I need another Black person here. I need someone to help me. And he had worked his way up. Like, I think he started as a assistant for Tracy Jordan, who was like the head of talent, music and talent at MTV, like in the mid-80s. And and that's when Stephen Hill was there, and he worked his way up to becoming an executive. And yeah, and he was like, and at the time, hip hop was really, you know, a big force, and MTV was still in denial about that, and they didn't want a lot of hip hop on the channel. And it was hard for him. You know, I think it was really hard for him. It was hard for me. So I would just be like, there came a point where Fred just started tapping out and I had to just like take over the reins and yeah.
So,
but I learned a lot from him.
Did you know what you wanted to do next when you finally had reached your limit?
I thought I was like, you know, I wanted to go back on the label side. And so I thought every record label was like Def Jam and it wasn't. And so I ended up leaving and I also thought like part of the reason why I left, even though I probably could have stayed there for forever, it just felt like there was no growth there for me. Like you would just be there for forever. And there was no growth. Like you are at MTV at the time was the place where it was the ultimate radio channel, right? It was like where all the music was played, all the video. It was like the peak. Like, where do you go from there? BET? Like, where do you go?
Yeah.
And so I was like, I needed to be somewhere where I could grow with the company and do something else besides being, you know, head of music and talent in my 50s, you know, like that just didn't seem dope to me because I actually wanted to create. I actually wanted my ideas to be heard. I didn't want to just be around talent all the time. I felt like I was a talent wrangler, you know, and it was awesome. Like, yeah, I got to, you know, work with Jay-Z, work with Outkast, like work with the Neptunes. But it was just, it was also that, you know, especially being a woman, you were just like, oh my gosh, I'm like the babysitter, mm-hmm. you know? And so I, you know, L.A. Reid at the time had just started working at Arista. And, you know, you had access to pretty much everybody at every record label because they all had to come through MTV. And so, you know, I told him that I was looking to leave. And he was like, yeah, I think you should come work at Arista. And it was just, I mean, at the time, it actually ended up being the opposite of, you know, Def Jam, of MTV, where it was this diverse, multicultural place. Like, L.A. Reid was like an R&B dude. And so everybody like that was at Arista at the time came from LaFace, and they were, you know, mainly there was like, he wasn't a hip hop dude at all, but it was mainly R&B and Outkast. I just feel like he looked up on. And then there was also just like a lot of toxic, like, just like, yeah, being a woman, they were like, well, like, how do you know this dude? How do you know L.A. Reid? Like, how did you get here? What are you really doing here? Like, people started questioning me, and that I didn't get there for my ability, that I didn't get there from even my connections. But like, clearly I got there for other reasons. And it was just like, really, which wasn't true at all. And that was really challenging because it, you know, a lot of things that I was into, like I loved, you know, hanging out with the guys, with L.A. Reid and Mark Schimmel at the time. And they would, you know, be at Four Seasons, like smoking cigars, talking business. Like, that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about, yeah, how this record sold and like what we need to do next. I don't want to talk to my girlfriends about what dude we're trying to get with, or, you know what I mean? I'm not saying that all women mm-hmm. want to talk about that, but that was the idea. It's like, well, if you're hanging out with these dudes, then it must be you, you know, you must be sleeping with someone. And it was like, that theme was like, couldn't have been further from the truth. And it was like a huge distraction because it was like, I really want to move up in this business. And I literally can't because I'm a woman, because people assume that I'm only good enough to sleep with someone or be someone's girlfriend or be someone's wife. Like, that was literally like, that had to be my goal. And it made me really sad. I ended up leaving. Well, I got laid off. It was both, but I was in a contract. So I was able to like really think about what I wanted to do. And music was not it. It was just like toxic. It was only a place for men to succeed. And it just, I didn't know what to do about it. So I also, during that time, I met Chris, who's now my husband. I met him pretty early on when I was working with James Jebbia, and we were dating for a long time, and then we broke up. But before we broke up, I was like connected him with James, because he was, you know, he used to work for a snowboard and ski place called Blades. And he worked really hard. He was like really good worker. And I was like, dude, you're too good for this. Like, let me introduce you to James. And kind of like wanted him to meet him just so he could at least like, cause he was in school at the time. He was in college. So, you know, and like James had always helped me. So I was like, oh, maybe he could help Chris. And so, but me and Chris had broken up. We weren't talking even, because I started working in the music industry and I was really like, it was really all about my work. And so we didn't talk for years, and then we got back together around the time I was working at Arista when we got back together. So then when I left, I got pregnant and I decided I wanted to focus on my family, and we moved out to LA. me and Chris and Solomon in my belly. And then, yeah, started a whole new thing here. And he was working at Union. He, you know, because it's all connected, Union, New York. James was friends with a guy named Eddie Cruz, who owned the Union in L.A., James and Marianne. But he's eventually who we bought the store from. We bought Union from. But Chris had been working at Union New York for like for years. And then, you know, and then in Union LA. So he was ready to take it over because he knew everything that was wrong with it and everything that was right with it. And he knew what it needed to like really grow.
At this point in the story, it's important to acknowledge that two of Beth's previous bosses, L.A. Reid and Russell Simmons, have been rocked by Me Too scandals. In our conversation, Beth spoke only with gratitude for the doors that they helped her open and did not mention any of their alleged bad behavior. I didn't feel it was right to put her in a position to either denounce or defend either of these two men who, by her account, were instrumental in her professional elevation. After all, this is her story and not theirs. Have you ever had a big idea but lacked the tools to implement it? Look no further than Shopify. Shopify is the brand that powers all your favorite clothing, beauty, and sneaker brands and offers the best-in-class commerce tools to allow you to sell online, in person, and on all major social platforms. Shopify fuels millions of entrepreneurs and turns ambition into action. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. Now back to the story.
At the time, you know, Union was just a multi-brand store. And, you know, it was, I believe it was James's first store. And so, you know, it didn't really make a ton of money because it was just, you know, selling a lot of other people's products. And then at the time, like, especially when Chris took over the buying part of it, he, you know, brought in a bunch of higher, more expensive brands. So like Duffer, he eventually bought in Bape. And it was just expensive. Obviously, we would make the money back, but that was it. There wasn't, you know, a lot of revenue to make off of other people's products. And I don't know for sure. I can't quote. I don't know why James started Supreme, but I'm guessing that's why he started Supreme, just to have his own private label, and which was smart. And so, but at the time, Chris just knew it so well, and he became like a really good buyer, and he brought in like all these really dope brands. But yeah, at the time, like Chris really changed, like, you know, Union went from being kind of really like a skate like hip hop shop to like a very high end clothing store. But again, it was just like, it just couldn't, you know, you were like limited on its growth because the brands were so expensive and you were just, you know, paying that back. So eventually they decided to sell it, and Chris took it over. You know, we found the money and he was able to buy it.
So you guys set up shop in LA, mm-hmm. You opened the store here, mm-hmm. and you were, I'm in the early stages of motherhood, which is a like 3 full-time jobs in one.
Yes.
And getting this business off the ground, what was that like?
I definitely like was depressed when I, you know, after leaving Arista and just going through all that, it was really devastating. And then going from that to being a new mom, which was also this very new thing. I think I was like 28 at the time. So I wasn't like super young. I had a life already. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, motherhood, it was like a big teaching moment. Like I learned a lot about myself. It was very lonely at first because I was really the first of my friends to even have kids. Like no one at 28 from New York was like having kids. That was like all in the scene, you know? And so It was really lonely. Like I lost a lot of friends. A lot of people were like, what's going on? You know, and then I also wasn't able to be as ambitious, you know, because it wasn't about me anymore. And it was about this other person, which was good, which was like partly a relief, but then partly like, oh, wow, like it's not about me. And it wasn't. It wasn't about me. It was like, it was about Solomon and it was about Chris and it was about all these other people. Which was hard. Like it was a huge transition for me because I actually had a career and I had a bunch of things happening from a very young age. Then to go from like I still worked when I was pregnant. I worked at MTV, like on some like reality shows doing wardrobe and styling.
In this time after having your first child, you've sort of ended your first phase of your career. Like, what was the process of bringing your ambitions back into focus?
It was a whole new learning of, I went through an identity crisis because I didn't know who I was anymore. Like, you know, becoming a mom, I was just like, I was a mom now. But still super ambitious. And then seeing Chris and like streetwear becoming this thing. And I remember being like having a conversation with Chris, like he's like, what do you want to do? Like, well, what did you used to love to do? And I was like, this, like I've been a part of this. Like, it was like, I was kind of fighting the whole streetwear thing because it was like, I really felt like because I was a mom and I was a woman and I was also a little scared to just go back in that space. But obviously I was protected now because I had a husband. I was protected, but then also made invisible. And so it was just like everything that I was doing before, it was like, you know, like time was moving on, like MTV no longer was even a thing. Like everything that I was doing, the music industry, hip hop was changing, fashion was changing, and streetwear was this new thing. And it was very much about these dudes, mainly rappers, and their girls and their hot girls. And it was like all these girls. And I just remember, you know, like at Union, like working, like what I used to do at Union early on was I was really head of marketing and I would do social media basically. And, you know, a lot of our social media feeds would be just like tumblers of just like naked women, half naked women, like women in fucked up situations. Like, you know, that was streetwear at the time, like early. I mean, it still is. Just like really like problematic. Like we would just do like our Friday feels would be just like. And I still felt young and cool, but I was just like, I'm not trying to be half naked for people.
Frustrated with her experience in both music and streetwear, Briquette took a moment in the early aughts to step back and reconsider her ambitions. A few years earlier, she'd introed her husband, Chris Gibbs, to old friend James Jebbia of Supreme fame, who sold the two his store, Union. So the two moved to LA, started a family, and built their family business.
How were you guys thinking about growing the Union brand in that period of like late aughts, early, you know, whatever, teens?
So that was a thing, right? I mean, I realized, yeah, James Jebbia started a clothing brand because that makes the profit. Like we can't even sustain like selling other people's clothing. We need to have a private label. The margins are too low. And I'm like, and you know, Chris was, his whole thing was like, well, I'm not a designer. And I'm like, but you don't have to be. I mean, even restaurants have like merch, right? They have like a t-shirt and a hat and a mug. And it's like, even that would be fine, you know, because people like, it's just one little store. People just want a piece of it. And I remember this being like, this was like a real issue, like in our relationship. Like he was just like, felt like I was being like really pushy about it. But I was like, this is what we need. And so obviously it had to come from someone else and not from me for him to finally start. But it also like, he just, you know, he just works differently, you know, and we're both very different in our approach. And, but I'm saying, me being like more aggressive and more assertive hasn't always been appreciated. And so that's been the challenge, like me even questioning myself, like, is it okay to be assertive? Is it okay to be, you know, this way? But yet it's okay for men to kind of be every different way. Like, oh, I need to take my time. Okay, take your time. Like, I wish I had that luxury, you know?
What would you say is the key to managing, you know, a family-run business like that?
I mean, I do think that we kept it a family. Like, I was very much involved. Like, we have a very small staff that is like our family. You know, almost everybody is still there from the beginning. I mean, yes and no. But that's what it is. Like, a lot of times, like, every time we had an event or something to do, like, the kids would be, you know, working as well, like, bringing the kids in, because we didn't necessarily have money for babysitters and nannies then, you know? So it was like, you know, it was just kind of all hands on deck. And, but that's what it felt like. It didn't feel like, you know, so people don't, I started feeling like maybe how my mom felt with my dad, like, not appreciating what you're actually bringing to the table. So that's why even more so, I was like, I have to do my own thing. I have to do my own thing because, you know, my husband thinks I'm trying to control his thing. And I'm not. I'm just trying to like navigate it to a place where we can like make money. And so finally, when we were able to do that, like every job I did, I just put it back into my brand, into Beffy's, into what we're doing, even Union, every job, everything we did outside of Union went back into Union. So it was really hard to like make that transition.
When did you decide formally, like, I'm going to start my own business? It's going to be called Beffy.
I mean, that's the thing. That's why Beffy's Beauty Supply is new. It started during COVID.
Really?
I'd been wanting to do Beffy's for a long time. And like I said, I had done little runs like with social studies.
Yeah, collabs.
I had done even ComplexCon with Union. But I wasn't able to really focus on it until recently.
What was it that was the catalyst that sort of brought Beffy's Beauty Supply as a brand into focus for you?
Well, it was time. It was the beginning of COVID. And I remember, you know, you reevaluate everything. You're like, what's next? And I remember wanting to do a brand, but also being like, but do we need more clothes in the universe? Like, do we need another clothing line? You know, as much as that's what I know, like I know clothes. I know design, I know fashion, I know styling, I know costume design. So it felt really familiar, but I also was like, it just felt like not what we needed. And so I really wanted it to be a marketplace to help other women and other women of color, because I felt like it was the hardest for us, you know, because we don't necessarily have access to capital. And then you're a woman, which is like really hard, you know, to even be taken seriously. But at least if you have capital, you can be like, oh, here, you know, throw some money on it, you know? So that's what really drove me to. And then, you know, with everything going on in COVID and obviously like, you know, it was a crazy time, right? Like we had to apply for all these loans just to keep Union, you know, afloat. And then we had other things going on, so we were okay. And I was like, imagine all these other businesses, all these other small businesses, especially of like people of color who are not going to be able to survive this. And so I just wanted to like help, like even if it didn't mean financially, it just meant like with my connections and my knowledge and what I know. I just wanted to like help other young girls or young people make it a little easier for them where it wasn't for me.
Speaking of that, I wanted to ask, I know you wrote an essay for High Snobiety in 2019. You talked a lot about sort of this erasure and the many trials and tribulations of being a woman or woman of color in streetwear.
Or period.
How do you feel like this world and as well as frankly the larger world has changed since you wrote that?
I mean, it was changing when I was writing that, right? There was this whole, like, people were actually, yeah, questioning, why aren't there women in streetwear? So even that was like the first, right? It was like, whoa, people care, people want to know. And it was like, oh, well, who actually was in streetwear? Oh, is it Marianne? Is it Aaron? Like, who is it? Who are these women? And then obviously, like, you know, with everything that happened with people just like waking up to like all the, not only sexism that's going on, but racism that's going on. I think it's made it a little easier to have a platform like Bethy's Beauty Supply, where you can talk about empowering other, you know, Black and Brown women. It's really just like the climate. And so I do think timing is everything, right? So, and luck, which luck and purpose, because it all kind of comes together. So I don't know, the stars kind of aligned, but maybe they were supposed to align. So yeah, I think it was just, I really do believe that everything happens for a reason, and everything that's supposed to happen to you is supposed to happen to you for you to fulfill your purpose. You know, even the bad thing, especially the bad thing.
You've launched Bethy's Beauty Supply doing in a very boutique way with, you know, organic, small drops, limited runs. What do you imagine the brand to look like at maturity?
I like to keep it small and limited. I really think that idea did come from, you know, the streetwear came from, you know, the Union, the Supreme, the undefeated models of like limited edition or limited supply of things, creating more demand. But it also keeps like your costs down for like having a ton of people. Like, I love how a lot of those companies, like, even though they appear to be really big, they're really small. And so keeping like just like a small group of people and then just kind of like passing the baton, so they are also able to open up their own brands and companies, and like we all help each other, as I feel like I've been helped and Chris has been helped, and, you know, we've been helped, but we also put the work in. But that let everybody can eat, that we don't need just like one big corporation like controlling everybody, and we all have to work for everybody. I believe that we can have a bunch of corporations or a bunch of not corporations, but businesses that are community-based. And I think it's just, it's really good for the environment. It's really good for communities, you know? Yeah, I think it's totally possible. I just think it's going to take probably a long time for people to like rethink, you know, how they shop, rethink how they even want to work. There's like a lot of rethinking going on.
So as you, you know, grow this business in this very deliberate manner, like, what are the steps that are involved in doing that?
Oh, the steps are, well, right now I'm revamping everything. So it's just revamping our identity. I think, you know, we need to be more clear about what it is that we sell or not sell.
Which is?
What we sell. Okay. We sell, I mean, I do clothing, but very small. Like, we do merch. Like, we definitely do a t-shirt, definitely do a hoodie. And it's definitely inspired by, you know, some really dope, you know, woman or woman of color that's maybe been hated on, the underdogs. And then also doing like a lot of hair accessories, because I'm obsessed with hair. Hair is everything. but making it fun and not this chore where you're like, oh, I have to get my hair done. It's like, oh, what am I going to put in my hair today? So really just like making fun hair pieces, hair accessories that you can wear, you know, on your clothing, but you can also wear in your hair, and just like, just, you know, not taking ourselves so seriously, but also elevating these hair accessories and keeping them small and special, collaborating with more creatives that specialize in hair, with more hairstylists, and also doing just more collaborations across the board and incorporating, you know, hair and hair accessories into even some of the bigger brands that I collaborate with, like a Jordan or, yeah.
Do you have a Jordan collaboration?
I do have a Jordan collaboration coming out, and supposedly it's going to be coming out in June of 2022. I say supposedly because like these drops get moved all the time, just based on, but yeah, but it's happening. I'm excited.
Congratulations.
I'm excited about, never thought I'd be designing a shoe, but designing a Jordan 7. So yeah, and some apparel as well. And of course, some accessories, some hair accessories. So
when you reflect on the last 15 years of being in this apparel and retail business, what are the most important lessons that you would share with someone, a young person that's thinking about entering into the space?
Yeah, I would say that, like, you know, really, as hard as the hard parts are, like the real difficult times when you just like, you feel like you're just giving up and you're maybe not, you're not feeling so great about yourself, is when you actually get to learn about yourself. And the more you know about yourself, the more you love you love those things about yourself. You see what your strengths are and your weaknesses. And so I think that those are the most valuable times that that young people should be paying attention to. I know it's hard. A lot of kids come to me, a lot of them wanting advice, like, hey, how can I, you know, how can I be like a mom like you, or how can I run a business like you? And I'm just like, everybody has their own path, and you should want your own path. Because I couldn't tell anybody what my path was going to be. I had to just be in it.
You recently appeared on a reality competition show, The Hype, on HBO Max. Mm-hmm. How does that fit into sort of your larger ambitions with Beffy's Beauty Supply and just your career in general?
Well, originally, I mean, I really did the show to promote Beffy's Beauty Supply, to be able to use, you know, to have a bigger platform. But what I didn't realize is that I would be doing what I'm already doing, which is like just helping the kids like navigate this, you know, this world, whether it's like launching their own brand or, yeah, just telling them the stuff that I've learned and encouraging them to keep on keeping on.
Sort of a theme in this conversation has been you feeling that you've always had to play the back, and that not necessarily getting the credit for the creative decisions that you've made and the influence that you've had. You are now on camera with very nice lighting in front of millions and millions of people. Is that gratifying?
It's different. I feel like people still don't really know how I've contributed and who I am. And that's okay. Like, I think that as long as, you know, people see people like me doing things, that hopefully it will inspire them to believe they can do it too.
What are the wins that keep you engaged and excited and happy?
I think just like the process of having to figure it out, not knowing. I think the minute it starts getting like predictable is when it's not fun anymore. I think I like the fact that like every day is something different. Just things happen all the time, or something comes up and you have to like quickly shift and problem solve, and it never stops. But I think as long as you love the process, then that's all it is. Because once you get to the destination, it's kind of over. You're like, what's next?
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Idea Generation, featuring Beth Burkett. We hope this episode illuminated some of the systemic challenges that unfortunately exist within music and fashion, but we also hope that it showed you how one can overcome them.
What is success?
Success is different for a lot of people. For me, success is being able to do what you love and being able to do it with the people that you love. Always being able to be around and to help and motivate the people that you love around you.
Thanks to our partners at Shopify, who help us make this whole thing possible. And if you're trying to sell something online or IRL, they can probably help you too. Check out their services at shopify.com/ideas. Next week, I'll be speaking with independent rap god Freddie Gibbs.